and welcome once again to the Turkey Book Talk podcast. I'm William Armstrong, and in this podcast I talk to authors about newly released books on Turkey and its region, which I've reviewed in the Hürriyet Daily News. This week I spoke to Nilgün Önder about her detailed new book called The Economic Transformation of Turkey, Neoliberalism and State Intervention, which explores the paradoxical effects of economic reforms pushed through after the military coup of 1980. The book argues that root and branch changes to open up the Turkish economy after 1980 with support from the IMF and the World Bank actually led to an expansion of repressive state power over the Turkish economy and society. Rather than rolling back in classic liberal fashion, the authority of the state was substantially deepened through the 1980s. I started by asking Nilgün Önder to outline the argument that she makes in the book.
Yes, absolutely. The main argument of the book is that the state was the main agent for the neoliberal transformation of the Turkish political economy throughout the 1980s and the 1990s. This role took two major forms. The first form was more a negative type of intervention. As I explain it in the book, negative state intervention involved basically removing, dismantling the earlier regulations, institutions associated with the more state interventionist, trade protectionist, import substituting industrialization, which was the main economic policy in the 1960s and 70s. And this negative form of intervention was also highly active, removing earlier restrictions on foreign trade, liberalizing the foreign direct investment regime of Turkey through also various multilateral and bilateral trade agreements and also foreign direct investments. Also, removing the earlier legal institutional restrictions on the international movements of finance capital, for example, purchasing and selling of bonds, equities, etc. In the initial years, that was the type of state intervention in the economy that attracted the most attention. But as the Turkish government learned very quickly, the free market economy happens not only through just removing whatever legal political restrictions there are in the way of the operation of the free market, but a more or less smoothly functioning a liberalized market economy requires new sets of institutions. And Turkey was one of the first countries, not only one of the first developing countries, but just countries in general, to embark on a neoliberal transformation. Well into the 1990s, even the main international economic organizations advocating neoliberalism, namely the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, had focused their attention on that negative type of state intervention so as to create a free market economy. But soon after the Turkish government started liberalizing the economy and integrating it into the international economy, there was a major crisis. So such negative type of neoliberal reforms led to high instabilities in the economy, especially in the banking sector, in the financial market, and a major crisis in the very early 1980s. So the Turkish government quickly learned that the neoliberal transformation of the economy required another type of state role as well. And I called it the positive type of state intervention. Of course, my intention is not to attach values to these adjectives, negative and positive. But as I define it, negative meant removing the earlier restrictions and dismantling the earlier economic and political economic institutions. The positive type of state intervention was very crucial to stabilizing and consolidating neoliberal reforms That type of intervention took the form of creating a new set of economic institutions, political institutions, a new set of regulations and rules to enable the now liberalized economy to operate without requiring direct form of state controls, direct types of state intervention in the economy. Of course, this didn't happen overnight. It took a number of years. There was definitely a trial and error process. Some institutions didn't work. As a result, they had to be reformed, or new sets of institutions had to be created. A very significant type of new institution in that regard was the creation of new prudential and supervisory institutions, regulations for the banking sector, for the financial market as a whole. For example, a new banking law, a new supervisory agency for the banking sector, and also the creation of, especially at the very beginning of the neoliberal reforms, or in the first half of the 1980s, some new economic institutions, but state economic institutions, were created to promote the export reorientation of the economy. For example, the Export Credit Bank, it would provide incentives for Turkish exporters to make their exports more competitive in the international market. So yes, as I argued, the neoliberal transformation of the economy, of the Turkish economy, as in many other countries, relied on active state intervention. And also another key argument of the book is that a crucial aspect of this new type of state intervention in the economy was in the area of industrial relations, more specifically the collective bargaining system, relations between employers and workers, labor unions. That type of state intervention in industrial relations played a major role in shifting power further away from organized labor in favor of employers. And that was realized through new labor laws, for example, a new collective bargaining act, a new labor union act starting in 1983. And these new pieces of legislation introduced a significant number of restrictions on the activities of labor unions, on their rights to strike. And that type of state intervention in the system of industrial relations definitely benefited significantly employers. And that in turn also basically helped Turkish exports to become more competitive. How? By suppressing wages. At least in the initial stages, the reorientation of the Turkish economy towards exportation, away from the earlier policy of import substitution, took place through the suppression of wages and also through the restriction of labor actions, such as more specifically strikes, whether legal strikes or illegal strikes. So yes, as the book argues, the state, its role was key to the neoliberal transformation of the Turkish economy throughout the 1980s and the 1990s. A free market economy doesn't just happen spontaneously and naturally, unlike what neoliberal economists argue. Actually, to quote Karl Polanyi, who was writing in the 1940s, the road to the free market was actually opened and kept open by increased state intervention. And the Turkish case is an excellent example of that statement, of that argument. And I show it throughout the book, how the neoliberal transformation of the Turkish economy relied on the state as the key agent.
Those reforms that were pushed through came after a military coup in 1980, but plans to reshape the Turkish economy were actually in place before the coup. And
yes.
There were the famous January 24th decisions of Süleyman Demirel's Justice Party, which heralded the comprehensive IMF-led economic restructuring program. But you describe in the book how Turkey's political system before the coup was almost too messy to follow up with this program, and it could only be realized by a more repressive post-coup military regime. How did that play out?
The new state form, the exclusionary authoritarian state form, started to take shape in the wake of the launching of the 24 January program. That was the starting point of the neoliberal transformation of the Turkish economy. So as you pointed out, the 20 January economic program was launched under a multi-party parliamentary regime and by a center-right political party. It was in response to a serious economic crisis in Turkey. At the same time, there was also a political crisis, a highly polarized, fragmented political party system, and also increasing terrorist activities in the country. So it was a very dire situation, both politically and economically. But soon after the adoption of the program, it was also clear to the government and to the international financial institutions that under the given political conditions, it was nearly impossible to implement the reform package effectively. Two major reasons was ongoing political crisis and very dysfunctional parliament, because it was polarized. There was a strong opposition to the neoliberal 24 January program, both within the state apparatus, among more pro-state interventionist bureaucrats in higher ranking positions in some ministries, but also in the parliament, more specifically the more left-leaning political party, the major political party at the time, the Republican People's Party, was not supportive. And also there was opposition outside the state apparatus, and that opposition was based on the highly mobilized leftist movement, but also highly mobilized organized labor, the labor union movement. There were a lot of strikes in the country. There were thousands and thousands of workers on strike. As a result, under the prevailing political conditions, it was clear that the package couldn't possibly put into effective implementation. It required many changes in the existing piece of legislation, the restructuring of the state apparatus, and the government itself was not strong enough to carry through these reforms. Of course, I don't mean to argue that the military regime, the military simply stepped in order to implement the 24 January package. That is not my argument. But the situation was, without a highly repressive authoritarian regime, it would be impossible to carry out such far-reaching economic program, economic reforms in such a short period of time. And well, the military coup took place in 1980, and the military government immediately invited the architect of the 24 January package to be deputy minister in charge of economic affairs in the newly created military government, namely Turgut Özal. Turgut Özal was key to the continuation of the 24 January program. And since organized labor had been suppressed, the leftist movement was suppressed. Of course, there were no more free functioning political parties during the military regime of 1980-1983. It was not that difficult for the military government to carry out the economic reforms, which were really laid out in the 24 January program. So the program, the reform program, had been launched by a civilian government just before the military regime, but the civilian government could hardly carry through the reforms, and the military regime made it possible for the neoliberal transformation of the economy to continue without any significant opposition.
And it was very paradoxical in a way, because the military authorities were simultaneously trying to install very highly nationalistic, militaristic political and social policies, while at the same time opening up Turkey to the harsh transnational economic winds and forces of globalization. So in a way, it was like they were trying to close the country politically while opening it up economically.
That is a good observation, absolutely. At first glance, it seems paradoxical, and at the time it was puzzling to many observers how the Turkish military embraced the opening of the Turkish economy to the international market forces. It was at the time, it sounded quite puzzling. When we read various statements, interviews conducted by the Turkish generals who carried out the coup and controlled the regime for several years after the coup, what I gathered was that many of them were convinced that there wasn't really another alternative. That was keeping the support, securing the support of the international financial institutions, and thus securing the further continuation of loans to Turkey were the only way out of the deep economic crisis. But at the same time, as I explained in the book, it wasn't only the outside force in the form of the international financial institutions that convinced the military government to embrace the neoliberal package. The support was also from within the country. And the key support was from the bigger companies, especially the Association of Turkish Businessmen and Industrialists, to use the Turkish acronym, TÜSİAD. TÜSİAD had become a major supporter of the restructuring of the Turkish economy towards more integration with the international economy. The representatives of big Turkish companies also were quite active lobbying the international financial institutions to secure their support for the Turkish program, economic program. So the Turkish generals, of course, knew that many major Turkish industrialists and finance companies were now supportive of the neoliberal transformation of the economy. So there were both domestic and international reasons for the Turkish military to embrace and continue the more or less the 24 January decisions after they carried out the coup. So that was a major shift from the earlier position of the Turkish military, supportive of, yes, more trade protectionist, more direct state interventionist economic program, because throughout the 1960s and 70s, they constituted an important support base for the import substitution industrialization of the Turkish economy. Even in the 1970s, they continued to, the higher ranking generals continued to speak of deepening Turkey's industrialization through deepening import substitution industrialization, again, of course, maintaining a closed economy. So that was an important political and ideological switch on the part of the Turkish generals to embrace the 24 January package and basically implement the reforms effectively.
Yeah, and the election of 1983 was the first general election after the coup. And the winner was the Motherland Party, led by Turgut Özal. And this was not the military's favoured choice, but once the political authority was handed over and the Motherland Party took over, it continued the economic reforms demanded by the military. Could you explain this process?
As you know, the head of the Motherland Party was the same person who was the main brain behind the 24 January decisions, namely Turgut Özal. So basically, Turgut Özal really personified also the continuity of the neoliberal package. He was key to the adoption and implementation of the 24 January package just before the military regime. And as I noted, he was also invited by the military government to join the military government to oversee the implementation of the economic program, and he accepted the position. He had to resign about 2 years later because of an economic crisis, but he continued to be active. And when the military government signaled that it was time to start a transition to a civilian regime, then Turgut Özal, yes, created the Motherland Party. And yes, the Motherland Party wasn't the party favored by the generals. Actually, the military regime had created their own political party, which was the Nationalist Democracy Party, and it was headed by a retired general. So at the time, many observers, and of course the generals themselves, expected that the Nationalist Democracy Party would win the elections because it was getting significant support from the military regime in many ways, but that was also probably counterproductive in the end. Although initially the military regime was, well, overall welcomed by the general Turkish public because many people were fearful of increasing terrorism, but as time passed, as the military regime became highly repressive, there was increasing discontent among the general population. So yes, the Nationalist Democracy, the Nationalist Democratic Party failed to win the elections. Actually, it did really poorly in the election, and the Motherland Party was the victor. The election wasn't entirely free and fair. Candidates, political parties were screened by the military government, basically, and a number of many candidates. Candidates from various political parties and a number of political parties themselves were basically vetoed, so they were not able to compete. But the Motherland Party was allowed to compete, and it succeeded. It came in first, and it received support from all sections of society. So one reason, not the only reason, but one reason why the military government allowed the Motherland Party to compete in the elections, despite the fact that they saw the Motherland Party getting a lot of support, was the fact that Turgut Özal was well known internationally. He had good international connections. He had worked for the World Bank actually before he was invited back to Turkey to head the 24 January economic package. So the military government realized that if they had vetoed Turgut Özal, they would have received a lot of protest reaction from Western governments and also from the international financial institutions. The Motherland Party government, of course, continued the neoliberal transformation of the economy. Turgut Özal was the most ardent supporter of Turkey's neoliberal transformation, Turkey's opening to the international economy. And the election platform, the election campaign of the Motherland Party in the first election, general election following the military coup, focused on economics, on economic policies. There was hardly anything in the campaign concerning democracy, democratic rights and freedoms. Well, that was partly because of various restrictions, of course, imposed by the military regime on the campaign, on the election campaign. But that democracy wasn't the priority of the Motherland Party government at all. For a number of years after it came to power, and again, it won the elections, general elections in 1987, so ruled the country until 1991, the Motherland Party government focused its attention on the economy, and it focused its attention on carrying out further economic changes, economic reforms, and also consolidating the earlier neoliberal reforms. And the excuse me, Motherland Party was very successful in terms of mobilizing support across social class divisions from many different socioeconomic groups. Its discourse appealed to different sections of society. Of course, it had become the main representative, political representative of Turkish big capital. But at the same time, the Motherland Party secured significant support, a significant amount of electoral support from workers, even public employees, small farmers, self-employed groups. So, as I argued in the book, the Motherland Party was able to build consent in civil society across socioeconomic groups, across social class divisions, to continue the neoliberal economic transformation. And that was, I characterized this as the first hegemonic attempt by the Turkish big capitalist class to establish its own hegemony in civil society, as opposed to continuing to rely on repressive state actions to serve its interest. So yes, the Motherland Party was very successful in framing neoliberalism in a way to popularize it. Its discourse was able to link neoliberal economic policies to the achievement, to the realization of the interest of all different groups. And this enabled the Motherland Party government to continue the neoliberal transformation of the economy with more or less great ease. And this time, of course, yes, the restrictive political framework continued. There were major restrictions on the activities of labor unions. It was very difficult for workers, public employees, to go on strike. However, in the electoral arena, same workers, for example, were still voting for the Motherland Party in the local elections or in the national elections. But that started to change towards the end of the 1980s, because there was a major disconnection started to take place between what the Motherland Party's discourse promised on the one hand, and what was happening on the ground on the other hand. As a result of direct state interventions in the system of industrial relations, as I had mentioned earlier, real wages continued to drop significantly, and also farmers, especially small farmers, lost out. So the economic life, the social life, was getting rather difficult for fixed income groups, public servants, for example, also workers in both the private and public sectors. And towards the end of the 1980s, there was an outbreak of labor actions. It took a number of years for workers to mobilize, not only because of the legal political restrictions on labor unions and labor actions, but as I mentioned, but also because of the significant political support the Motherland Party was able to mobilize across socioeconomic groups. However, as I mentioned, there was a disconnection occurring between what the Motherland Party government promised and what was happening in terms of the living standards of a great majority of the people. And in the spring of 1989, there was just a sudden outbreak of labor actions. It was more or less spontaneous. The labor unions, of course, were involved, but the labor union leadership was not in charge of these activities. In the end, they were kind of compelled to support it, but the movement was more from below. And there was also significant general public support for the labor actions during the 1989 Spring Movement. And workers were marching, demonstrating, walking on the streets as a group, just chanting. They were hungry. So there was a lot of general public sympathy for the mobilized labor movement at the time. And through such mass-scale mobilization, workers were able to secure higher wage increases during the collective bargaining rounds in 1990-1991. So that also started the disintegration of the Motherland Party's hegemonic project, because the neoliberal economic program was not really producing the kind of benefits that had been promised to the people, including subordinate interest, subordinate groups. And in the 1991 elections, the Motherland Party lost, but no other political party was able to secure the majority to form a majority government. And the Turkish political system moved back to, I said moved back, because that was the case in the 1970s, a period of weak governments, coalition governments. But I argued in the book that the 1991 election and election result was really important. It was important because there was a significant attempt to create a new popular political economic settlement. So instead of the earlier exclusionary neoliberal form of state, the attempt was to create and institutionalize a more inclusionary, democratic type of state. And that form of state would include the interests of subordinate groups in terms of economic benefits, social benefits. That attempt was made by a coalition government, which was formed by a center-left political party, the Social Democratic Populist Party on the left, and a center-right political party, the Through Path Party. The two parties had campaigned on a platform promising democratization, further democratization, and also their election campaign had emphasized distributive justice, redistribution of at least income economic benefits without necessarily endangering the interest of capital or endangering capital accumulation. But the promise, the election campaigns of both parties emphasize supporting higher wages for workers, public employees, and better distribution of social and economic benefits for other marginalized groups such as small farmers. So both the election campaigns of the two parties and also the government program they adopted promised a new political and economic settlement, but that promise never materialized. In the book, I explain that without major changes in the neoliberal economic program, it would be nearly impossible to implement the new promised political and economic settlement. That kind of new inclusionary type of state form would require a major change away from the neoliberal economy, basically. On the one hand, the neoliberal economic program from the early 1980s or so was quite successful in reorienting the Turkish economy away from more inward-looking trade protections, import substitution, industrialization, towards an outward-looking export-oriented economy. When we look at the figures with respect to Turkey's foreign trade, its proportion, the proportion of exports to Turkey's economy, the change is incredible. However, despite such economic successes of the neoliberal program, it also contained major structural weaknesses, as I try to show in the book. Some structural weaknesses, As was the case in a number of other neoliberalized countries, Turkey's economy became exposed to highly volatile short-term financial flows. Most of it was and is hot money movements, more speculative type of financial flows. And while Turkey's exports grew significantly in dollar amounts and also relative to Turkey's economy, the composition of Turkey's exports did not achieve a high level or more advanced type of technological transformation. Let me rephrase this. Turkey became an export-oriented country to a very significant extent, and the composition of Turkey's exports moved away from more primary commodities or raw materials, agricultural products, but more processed products, manufactured products, and also some machinery, electronics. However, compared to some other major emerging market countries, for example, South Korea, Turkey's exports are still poor in terms of information technology. In other words, more advanced information technology products constitute only a small proportion of Turkey's exports. And when we look at the current situation, we also see expanding current account deficit, including trade deficit. So these are some of the structural weaknesses of Turkey's neoliberalized economy.
While reading the book, I was again struck by how back in the 1980s, following on from the 1970s in many ways, parties were still largely defined by their economic programs, as opposed to today when Turkish politics is largely a battleground of competing identity-based parties. And it could be argued that the economic focus began to change when the post-1980 retreat of the state's welfarist character opened up space for Islamist parties to start providing services that were no longer provided by the state. What do you think about this question of the rise of Islamist parties in the context of these great post-1980 economic shifts in Turkey?
Well, there is definitely a major connection between the two phenomena. I have argued that if the promised new political economic settlement had been realized in the 1990s, that would have, if not prevented, but weakened the rising political Islamist movement at the time. The rise of political Islamism, political Islamist movement, basically started in the mid-1990s. The main Islamist party of the time, the Welfare Party, had emerged as the first party in the 1995 elections, and actually it came to power in a coalition with a center political party. At the time, the Welfare Party was not supportive of neoliberalism, actually. It had campaigned on an election platform highly critical of neoliberalism, especially the consequences, the socioeconomic consequences of neoliberalism. And the Welfare Party had promised an alternative economic program, what they called a just economic order. Of course, that they were by no means strong enough to carry out that kind of alternative program. But in short, definitely the adverse socioeconomic consequences of neoliberalism created the political conditions for the rise of political Islam from the mid-1990s on. And at the time, the Islamist political party or parties, and also various Islamist organizations outside the political party system, capitalized on major popular discontent with the adverse economic, socioeconomic consequences of neoliberalism. But by the end of the 2000s, neoliberalism had already become a structural feature of the Turkish political economy, and especially in the wake of the 2000-2001 financial crisis, neoliberalism was further consolidated through the creation of some new institutions. In the 2000s, when we look at, of course, the political party system, or the parties constituting the political party system in Turkey changed as well. Some older parties died, basically they lost any kind of support, and some new political parties were formed. And one of them was the current ruling Justice and Development Party. It was formed just in 2002, and it participated in December, I think it was in December 2002 national elections, and it was a major success for them. But the Justice and Development Party's election platform never really questioned the neoliberal framework of the Turkish economy. Rather, they embraced neoliberalism, while they focused on, as you noted, more identity politics, and they kept referencing Islamism, or they took Islamism as a reference point. But we shouldn't assume that just because currently the existing political parties do not really compete with each other on a more economic focus platform, there is no economic background to identity politics. Of course, there is an economic background to the identity politics. As I explained, a major reason, if not the only reason, a major reason for the rise of political Islamism from the mid-1990s on was the increasing inequality resulting from the neoliberal economic reforms, basically. But another economic background is the fact that the political Islamist movement is also based on a group of new international oriented enterprises, businesses. Their owners or managers are kind of Islamist in terms of their political orientation, in terms of their ideological orientation. But they do function within the neoliberal framework, and they did actually derive significant benefits from Turkey's opening to the global market forces. For example, they were they started to engage in exports, or they became subcontractors of bigger national or multinational companies. So there is also a significant group of Islamist-oriented businesses that support the Justice and Development Party. So there is obviously an economic subtext to prevailing identity politics, although the political parties hardly campaign on an economic platform challenging neoliberalism. Neoliberalism is now taken as the framework. It is a given rather than it is something to be challenged. It is just taken for granted, and then existing political parties may offer some particular different economic policies or some different benefits, but there is hardly any political challenge to the neoliberal framework of the Turkish economy, or to the neoliberal framework of the global economy as a whole.
That was Nilgün Önder talking about her very interesting book, The Economic Transformation of Turkey, Neoliberalism and State Intervention. I hope you've enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please do rate it on iTunes, which helps spread the word and make it easier for people to find. If you haven't already, you can subscribe via iTunes, Podbean, or SoundCloud. I've also made a Facebook page for the podcast, which I'm sure you can find by searching around on Google or Facebook. But until the next episode, thank you very much for listening. Venice.